It's really a delight to be here. And in terms of what I offer, I like listen to people. That if there's ever any requests, please request, because that's also part of it. But I try to listen inwardly and outwardly. And the Heart Sutra came up. I've always really loved the Heart Sutra. And then Rodney Smith, that is, some of you know Rodney Smith is a founding teacher of Seattle Insight. And he gave his last local retreat online a few weeks ago. And very interesting, he talked about the Heart Sutra and the Four Foundations of Mindfulness in the same retreat. It was very interesting how he did that. And so that kind of clicked in my heart also. And it seemed like, I don't know, was anybody there, by the way? Okay, well, yeah. So he was good. But the Heart Sutra is amazing. And to be sure, it's Mahayana, not Theravada. It's often called the single most commonly recited, copied, and studied scripture in East Asian Buddhism. It's like all over the place, in Mahayana. And it's a short, just like 2 pages. And it's just amazing. So I thought it'd be really good to explore, because it complements, and it sort of, I sort of, personally, I have, some of you know, kind of my practice, I have a Mahayana part of it and a Theravada. Yes. Yes, I did. And thank you. No, that's good though.
You don't.
That's one of your, that's, thank you. I always appreciate
I was like,
that.
this is going to be good. We've got to
No,
be good.
okay. I got this whole thing, which doesn't mean I remember, but I
Yay!
do have this. Yeah. So they complement these from my, in my heart, the Mahayana aspect and the Theravada complement, although this is essentially a Theravada sitting group. And Heart Sutras, it's kind of like, it's like jumping off a cliff. It's pretty amazing, almost disconcerting. And the cliff it jumps off, it pushes us off all of our concretizations about the nature of reality. It just keeps pushing, pushing, pushing in a very interesting way. And some of this may seem a little technical, so I apologize if it seems kind of weird and technical to any of you. But even for us Theravada practitioners, it points at the emptiness, the empty nature of the heart of all the teachings in Theravada world and everything. It's pretty amazing. It's not saying they're wrong, it's just saying they're empty, which means they lack inherent existence. It points out the ultimate nature of reality, and that every aspect is lacking in inherent existence, which can be kind of challenging, because we tend to concretize things. That's what we do. That's the default for humans. That's part of why we suffer, because we sort of concretize a self and we concretize another, and then this self wants that, and then we got problems. But the more we cut through that, the freer we are. But it can be kind of disconcerting, the Heart Sutra, because it seems like it's pulling the rug out from under us in different ways. So you can see what you think. And there's also, in terms of historically, it was delivered at Vulture Peak in Bihar, India, which is it's a pilgrimage, one of the key pilgrimage places in Buddhist world. I've been there. If you ever go, and you start from Bodh Gaya, get a car at 5 in the morning so you can get there before the tour buses, which is what the advice I got. So I did, and that was successful, because I climbed up there. It's a haul to get up there, but I climbed up there, and it was like nobody there when I got there. And 20 minutes later, everybody was there. So get there early. But it's amazing. It's a 1,300-foot mountain. Vulture Peak is. They're very prominent in the suttas in the life of the Buddha, and there's this little sort of stone platform about as, about as big as this whole end of the church. That's it. And a precipice just drops off. And when I've read in the past, when they talk about the Heart Sutra, they said all these bodhis and bodhisattvas were floating in the air. And I went, oh, actually, there's nowhere to stand, so they had to be floating in the air. But it's kind of edgy. It's a drop, and it's only 43 miles from Bodh Gaya, which is where the Buddha awakened. So it's a whole different world. That's like a serene valley. Bodh Gaya is right on this river, and this is up in the mountains. So it is, like I said, it is a Mahayana text, but the essence of it is right in the heart of what the Buddha taught, and it's complementary. I think it helps illuminate in some ways what the core of Theravada teachings are. And it was really interesting that that's what Rodney chose. I mean, I was kind of captured by that he wanted to talk about the Heart Sutra and the Four Foundations in one one weekend. So it's strict, you know. What is that from? Oh, is that what it is? Okay. There you go. Thank you. I'll mute you. It's all good. Thank you. So a pivotal aspect of it, it's not actually, the Buddha didn't actually teach it. It Avalokiteshvara taught it. And Avalokiteshvara is the Sanskrit word for Chenrezig, the Tibetan word, which is the Yidam of compassion. And you've probably seen these big Tonkas, you know, Tibetan paintings, just suns with a whole bunch of 1,000 white arms. That's Avalokiteshvara. And each one has an eye and the palm. And it's, the idea is it's expressing compassion toward all sentient beings. And the Dalai Lama is supposed to be a emanation of Avalokiteshvara. So it's the Yidam of compassion. And which is kind of interesting that this is about wisdom, basically. So that's kind of curious that he was teaching it. But Avalokiteshvara, they're on Vulture Peak, so you can try to visualize, they're on Vulture Peak, and it's kind of like very androgynous gender-wise. Avalokiteshvara was teaching Shariputta, who was the Buddha's lead disciple, who was the one who was most steeped in wisdom or knowing. And the Buddha was there, but he was deep in meditation. It's a very interesting scenario. You don't see elsewhere. He was like in this infinite vastness of mind, and there was this conversation going on, in a sense, reflecting what the Buddha was seeing. So it's a very interesting kind of situation. So you can look at what's going on as Avalokiteshvara is explaining to Shariputra, who is an arhat anyway, the infinite nature of mind or the empty nature of everything. So it's kind of powerful what's going on there. And it's helpful for us because, you know, on the path, part of the deal is that we keep getting stretched and we keep finding different places we're concretizing and we keep letting go. That's sort of how the path unfolds. It's like it's full of surprises. And so this is part of that, and just the way, the mere fact that he's teaching to an already awakened person, Sariputra, is so amazing because it's kind of like tweaking a little more, opening a little more, you know, opening a little more. So it's relatively short. So I'm just going to read most of the stanzas and then offer a little bit of explanation. And, you know, to be sure, very humbly, I am just a work in progress like y'all. So I often, stuff like this, 2 years later, I'll say, ooh, said that differently, or ooh, that wasn't, you know, all that. So here's the famous line. Form is empty, emptiness is form, emptiness is not other than form, form is also not other than emptiness. That's the most famous line from the Heart Sutra. Form is empty. There you go. Form is emptiness, emptiness, and see what I said about? Yeah, so it's really fascinating because the point here, I mean, this is the classic. This is the classic. It sort of opens up the whole thing's right there already. But emptiness is, you know, the lack of inherent existence of all phenomena. It's this vast understanding in Buddha Dharma, but it just emerges from form. It's not anything other than that this is inherent, lack of inherent existence. And it's not anything other than the emptiness of everything manifests. For starters, in form, not only in form, but you know, this is where we encounter it a lot. So it's so interesting because, you know, emptiness is arguably the hardest understanding to understand in the Dharma, or if we did understand it, we'd be Buddhas if we realized it. It's beyond like understanding idea of, but saw it. You know, if we saw it, we'd be awakened. So it's okay that it's hard. But it keeps opening things up. And what does it mean? You know, we tend, it's easy to think about emptiness and try to make it into a thing, to kind of deify it. And that's part of what this helps us not do, is this is just form. It's nothing different than just form, except form is empty. So right there, it's like, in that paradox, where do you go? You know, it's like that's the jumping off the cliff part in a way, because what do you do with that riddle? You know, what do you do with that riddle? But that is right in there. It's a place to practice. It's almost like a koan, you know, Zen koans and Rinzai practice, where they have these riddles that you can't solve, but you rest with them and then you see through. It's sort of like that, sort of like that in a way. So the emptiness that is the ultimate reality of existence arises inherently from form. And emptiness, it doesn't exist anywhere else other than arising from form. So they co-arise, they're interdependent. There isn't any inherent anything anywhere, is what the sutta is pointing us to. But now it keeps doing that in all kinds of different ways. And then Avalokiteshvara says, Shariputra, likewise, all phenomena are emptiness, without characteristics, unproduced, unceased, stainless, not without stain. So there's all this cryptic language in there. And there's, by the way, there's a million different translations of that. Thich Nhat Hanh did one recently, which is very nice because he kind of pulled some of the paradoxes out and explained them in his translation, which isn't exactly how the words are in the original text, but it's very beautiful. So that can be accessible in a way. So we're undermining concretization. All phenomena are emptiness. But it's even interesting when he's saying all phenomena are emptiness, not that they're empty as if it's a thing somehow inherent, but they all have this quality of emptiness. It's inherent in there. And even I'm using words that probably contradict them, but the point is that the nature of phenomena is that they're empty, but there's no there there. And when it says that they're unproduced and unceased, that's a hard one for me. Because in one way, with impermanence, everything's being produced and it's ever ceasing. But what this is saying is that if something arises, it doesn't arise into concretization, it arises into emptiness. So there's no permanence that it's arising into. So it's arising, but it's not produced as in there's a thing at the end of the arising. It's kind of keeping us from turning emptiness, keeping in from turning impermanence into creating things. And also when things go away, it's not like a thing that was stopped happening. It's just it was empty in the first place. Right? I know. I'm sorry. But it's kind of fun, right? So they're inherent. There's no concrete arising to an end result, and there's not a concrete ending. And then the next few words, stainless and not without stain. Like, what does that mean? And to be sure, I was doing some research, but I also had teachings on this and whatever. But when you think of something that's stained, we sort of think of an inherent reality that has been compromised by being stained, right? But this is stainless because it's empty. There's no stain on an empty thing. But it's also not without stain because everything has conditions. So both things are true. What's beautiful about this is it keeps, you know, if you sort of like bring it into your heart and think about any places where we'll tend to concretize things, and this kind of, whoops, pulls the rug out from under your feet. That's what's kind of amazing about this sutta. Why people have been chewing over this. And it kind of comes back, this is Mahayana, so it doesn't go back to the time of the Buddha, even though the Buddha was allegedly there. I'll pass on that illogic, but the first evidences of it are about the second century. There's some carved stone things where it's inscribed from about the second century, AD. But people have been chewing over this for centuries and centuries and centuries just because it's so evocative and it stretches you and it keeps on like, it's kind of confounding in a wonderful way. So now it gets even wilder in a way because it starts to see as empty the very factors that, especially in our Theravada tradition, we use as core markers on the path of awakening. So it's not saying they're wrong, but it's just saying they're empty. Because it's really easy when we, the Buddha's famous for lists, and a lot of you know, Four Noble Truths, Eightfold Path, Five Skandhas, all these lists, lists, lists. And people can get kind of didactic about that, they can get kind of fundamentalist about that, sort of, and start to settle into like, oh, yes, I got it nailed, this is how it is, but actually it's empty. But it's also pointing at something, and it's empty. So it kind of pushes us in that direction not to get concretized about it. So it doesn't mean, I mean, these are taught by the Buddha. It doesn't mean these lists are somehow wrong. On a conventional level, they're absolutely right. And, you know, they're pointing towards awakening. But it is keeping us from getting stuck there. It's pretty fascinating. So it starts with a, how you all doing? Is this too intense?
Can you redefine emptiness? Because the word, I think, means something like emptiness.
Yeah. It just means that everything lacks inherent existence. Like it's, then that's why Theravada. What's so wonderful about Theravada is it pretty much focuses on anatta. It's a matter of emphasis because they're essentially pointing in the same direction. Theravada emphasizes anatta, which is the lack of an inherent self of personhood, and emptiness. The Buddha also taught emptiness. Mahayana focuses in a broader way, but in a lot of ways, it doesn't get into the real heartfelt aspects of emptiness that are actually really useful for people in the 21st century, you know, because it's just how it is. So what does that mean? You know, I'm Steve, conventionally. Yeah, I'm Steve, and I'll keep being Steve, and I'm going to die Steve and all that. But where's the, is there sort of an essential Steveness somewhere? You know, that's what you, if you really start to look at it in practice, you can't find it. I mean, in practice, we start to, when we're being mindful and watching, just being mindful, and you start to see all these different, you know, our stories, our memories, our traumas, our factors, all this whole matrix of stuff appearing and disappearing. You know what I mean? It just comes and goes and comes and goes. And it becomes clearer and clearer that all that stuff's in motion. It's all changing all the time. The thing I think of Steve is a composite of all that, but once I get that, I actually can't find it, like this sort of homunculus Steve that's concrete and in there. It's not to be found. It's startling. It's undermining. It's kind of a little freaky when that happens, actually. And so emptiness is the same thing with all phenomena, because everything is in constant change. And even though this seems like it's static, it's not. And you know, and even though you know, it's like this whole thing with a chariot. It's the traditional things. When does a chariot stop being a chariot? If it's got wheels and you can pull it with a horse, but what if the wheels are on the ground and you can't pull it with a horse? Is it still a chariot or is it a pile of junk? You know, when that whole, all that stuff about identification and change and all that. Okay. Yes.
I'm kidding. I couldn't help it. No, I
And I should, we should do the mic thing. I forget. I failed.
No, I don't, I'm loud. It's okay.
No, but the people have to see you. The people have to see you on Zoom.
Okay. So, you want me to repeat it? No, I'm kidding.
Well, what am I smoking?
Said,
that was
smoking,
the question.
Steve?
Yeah.
Just totally kidding.
That's cool. I like it.
But,
yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm always curious. So I'm always trying to learn new things and whatever. So I know way back, The Course in Miracles was a, kind of a big thing.
And yeah, sure.
So I kind of checked that out for a bit, started the course, and it was talking a lot about, okay, look around the room, and everything you see isn't real. And so it I don't know, is that, it just...
I don't...
I know the whole overall is different. All,
yeah.
But it's just similar. I mean, it's like you all, it's like your whole reality, like you're saying, that whole thing with emptiness.
Yeah, I know just about this much about the Course in Miracles, so I can't comment. I think what's so elegant about the Buddha Dharma is, especially in Mahayana, that they use a phrase of the two truths, conventional and ultimate reality. Conventionally, you know, here we are. Ultimately, you can't find the...
Right.
Right. So both of those things are true simultaneously. And so when you say nothing's real, well, actually, sure, we're in a church, you know, it's got a roof. If it was raining, it'd keep it off. It got that. But ultimately, it's all in transition and it's all causes and conditions, and you can't find the ultimate church anywhere. We layer all kinds of labels on things.
Right.
Yeah.
And they talk a lot about ego. And has anyone else done the Course in Miracles? I haven't. I just dabbed it. You know, we just, but okay.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. Yeah, okay. It's all good. And Eric, can you move your head a little bit so that... There you go. Thank
Sorry.
you. Thank you, buddy.
You were using a term, comfortize?
Concretize.
What, can you please?
No, that's good. That's good. That concretize. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, concretize is to make things concrete. You know, to it is a word in the Dharma. No, it's not a Steve word. No, it's a Western Dharma word for sure. Yeah. But it's reify is another one that's often used. Yeah, reify is used a lot. Concretize, it means to make things concrete, to dream up concreteness. It's reify, yeah. Yeah. Re, R-E-I-F-Y. Yeah. Yeah, they're both words used in Western Dharma all the time. Yeah. Right.
All these things.
Can you give us some examples?
Well, it's kind of what we're talking about you know, the emptiness of self, and or the degree to which we really think that we cling to the idea of a self and concretize it or reify it and get locked into this idea of a permanence of self. When we really look in practice, you see, you can't find it.
That's one example.
Yeah. How about we proceed a little bit and see where we go here, and then see if. So this section starts with, and this is, I love this. This section starts with this is a little technical, but it's okay. I'm sorry. It's like your first time here. It's like, oh my God, it's one of those technical stuff. Usually we're much more mellow and sort of human. You're cool? All right. So this section starts with the five skandhas, which as some of you know, the five factors that make up a sense of self in a Theravada world, in almost a psychological world. They're body, vedanas, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness. From a Theravada point of view, that's the aspects from which we construct a sense of self. And here they're in there, and this is so cool because in the sutta here that we're talking about, the Heart Sutta, it starts going through these amazing lists and saying they're empty. And this is funny because it's kind of a double whammy because the skandhas are already pointing at that, but it's saying that not to get stuck. He said, Sariputra, therefore, in emptiness, there is no form, no feeling, no discrimination, no compositional factors, no consciousness, different words for the same five things. So he's sort of saying, don't even concretize the skandhas, because you could subtly concretize. It's all subtly. You can get into subtle kinds of concretization about these things that make up self. And it's, you know, there. If you take a look at those five, it's really interesting, actually, that starts off with form, body, and perceptions, or vedanas, that's pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, perceptions when we see colors, mental formations is a whole world of thinking, and emotions and all that stuff. And when you start to get into thinking, a lot of people say, that's me. You know, I think, therefore I am, right? That's me. But actually, it's just stuff happening. And consciousness, that's really hard to say. I'm conscious, and that's not me. So it gets subtler. But in the Heart Sutras, he's looking at all those things, but saying, and they're all empty, even though they're already describing the not-self of being. So it's kind of like just keeps pulling rugs out from under our feet. And the very puzzledness we're having is just what's so intriguing about this sutta, where it has attracted attention for a couple thousand, over 1,500 years doing my math, something like, you know, yeah, 2,000 years almost. That is amazing that this has been like people have been working with this for so long. So it's sort of telling us, don't take these factors as inherently existent, don't accidentally, inadvertently venture into thinking that the empty sense of self is made up of concrete, inherently existent phenomena. And then it points to this whole interlaced area of the six sense doors, you know, and also the perceptions of those doors, and also the things that they perceive, all of those are empty of inherent existence. And that's amazing because those are in the fourth foundation, the sense doors are, and it's pointing us to really kind of like, it just pulls you into kind of looking to see if there's some way we've been concretizing. The sutta says, it says no eye, no ear, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, no visual form, no touch, no odor, no taste, no object of touch, and no phenomena. There is no eye element and so on up to and including no mind element and no mental conscious element. So it's just brutal, boom, 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 yeah. List, right? Yeah. Yeah, right. No success. But so that means, for instance, you know, the physical eye, it's empty of inherent existence, as is seeing, which is what the eye does, and the object of sight that the eye sees. And it just helps, it, I think it's powerful because it helps us, you know, not inadvertently say, well, okay, but this part isn't empty. It's like, no, actually, that part is also. So every aspect of the whole perceptual process, how we contact phenomena, that's the whole deal, is all those sense doors and mind. So that's why there's six sense doors from a Buddhist point of view. So there's only, you know, there's only the emptiness, not to mention the tools of perception. And now it gets even more radical because it says, Sutta says, there is no ignorance, no extinction of ignorance, and so on, including no aging, death, and no extinction of aging and death. So that just seems crazy because the first part, no ignorance, no extinction, that's like a totally compressed version of the Four Noble Truths, which is suffering, the reason for suffering, the possibility of freedom from suffering, and the Eightfold Path, which is the very foundational teaching of the Buddha, saying, yep, it's there, but it's empty. And then also like no aging and death and no extinction of aging and death. Because we could, I mean, I get really kind of personally, you know, kind of working on the whole dying thing since it seems to be getting closer. And I can find myself want to concretize it and kind of get it comfortable. But it's just pushing to look through, you know, don't get stuck, don't get stuck. It's pretty amazing. I mean, I just, I can't. It's one of these things where, you know, we won't get it until we're awakened. So I'm humbly working it. But this is the one that really got me. I was looking at it for years. I've been going, you know, trying to figure that, see how that is. But it's getting clearer to me. So the point here is it keeps popping the bubble on any place where we would start to think things aren't empty. Any place where we sort of inadvertently, kind of sneakily concretize something over here just to kind of be comfortable and say, well, not that either, not that either. So it's just this sort of ruthless, in a loving way, compassionate ruthlessness, but unpacking of any place we could get stuck, which is just so amazing. Because it is our nature, you know, we sort of turn towards the ineffable. We with reverence, when things open up and we want to somehow coalesce it into something we can worship. And that's where, you know, I mean, I don't want to presume where other people are at, but the whole the degree to which there's God and it gets concretized by some people in some ways could be kind of like that. And I don't want to get into a theosophical discussion. God may be close to your heart and it's all good. But just the way, you can look at the way, you know, for some people, it's a guy on a throne. And I bet guy on a throne doesn't work for most folks. I don't know. Maybe it does. Maybe you are throne guys. Whatever. But you know what I'm saying? It is an instinct of humanity to try to make sense out of the inevitable and make it into something. That's okay. So in, you know, this is right in the core of emptiness, in the core of Mahayana Buddhism, where that's not what's happening. That's not what the Buddha awakening was. He saw through. You know, he was 2,600 years ago just to backtrack for a sec, because he was 2,600 years ago in India, surrounded in a time. It's a fantastic time where it was all these seekers were practicing and all these wandering sadhus. And in the suttas, he's constantly interacting with these wanderers that are out there meditating and practicing and looking for the nature of reality. So, but there's a lot of, you know, more theistic kind of stuff going on. It's a whole. And so even during his lifetime, in his 6 years of practice, between when he started, when he left the palace, and when he awakened, he studied with two great masters who were more in a concretized kind of way of seeing, and very quickly, because he was so capable, he went through all the layers that they had, and they said, oh, you can just teach with me side by side, you got it. And the Buddha said, no, this isn't it, I got to go. And so he did that twice, because he saw that there was something beyond, and that they'd gotten stuck on an incredibly subtle level, that for most people wouldn't be stuck at all. But from the Buddhist point of view, he intuited that was still stuck. He wasn't seeing through yet. So here's what Rodney Smith said, and I really appreciated it. I thought he did a really interesting job, I thought. He said, the Heart Sutra is unrelenting in terms of being uncompromised, he said. Awakening is awakening into reality free of mind's interpretation. The awareness that sees formations is the unconditioned. It's the beginning access to unconditioned reality. Okay.
The awareness what?
Go back, you know, further. Okay. It's good though, you're doing good.
Am I doing good? All right. I'll read it more slowly. Yeah, I'm going to read it slow. Okay, slowly. The Heart Sutra is unrelenting in terms of being uncompromised, he said. Awakening is awakening into reality free of mind's interpretation. The awareness that sees formations is the unconditioned. It's the beginning access to unconditioned reality. So we see formations, but it's unconditioned. That which sees is unconditioned. You know, it's like there's no self that is awakened. It's the unconditioned. That's what this practice is heading us for. But it's kind of disconcerting. It's kind of like jumping off a cliff, you know, because it's kind of keeps kicking out from under us ways that we might thought of. True. Yeah, because there's nowhere to get stuck. Yeah.
Nowhere on the road. It's nothing.
But really, when we see through concretizations, we begin to realize there's nothing to cling to, ultimately, and there's nobody to cling. And that's where this amazing freedom comes from. You know, look at these great masters, and you can tell there's like nobody home on a certain level. I mean, conventionally, they're functional, but on a certain level, there's this wide open space, and they're not stuck anywhere. Yeah, and some of the, you know, during the, very interesting, during the, after the Chinese invasion of Tibet in 1959, and a whole lot of great masters ended up in Chinese prisons for like 20 years in hard labor and stuff like that. And some of them came out. I can't remember who, there's a guy, he's actually still alive in Arizona, this great master, one of the few living masters, lamas from that era who are still alive. But he had his pointing out instruction also in Chinese prison. His master and he were both in Chinese prison. He had pointing out, he had to do all of his practice without actually ever moving his lips or showing he was doing it. But he did it. And he awakened while there. So amazing, you know, and because his master saw through, and it was a very inconvenient, no, it was not a good situation. There was pain. There was a lot of pain and difficulty and starvation and heavy labor, but not suffering. That's the deal, right? Not suffering, even though the conditions were outrageous. And, you know, I mean, that's part of the wondrousness of this practice, that it's a road to not suffer even. No matter. Yeah, no matter. So the sutta ends up with a conclusion in kind of the same taste. He says, Shariputra, therefore, because there is no attainment, bodhisattvas rely on and dwell in the perfection of wisdom, the mind without obscuration and without fear. Having completely passed beyond error, they reach the endpoint of nirvana. Yes, I'll read it again. Shariputra, therefore, because there is no attainment, there's no concrete attainment, okay? Bodhisattvas rely on and dwell in the perfection of wisdom, the mind without obscuration and without fear. Having completely passed beyond error, they reached the endpoint of nirvana. So it's this sense of fearlessness. It shows up in all the translations, without fear. It's very interesting. Yeah, without fear, because there's this ultimate shift where there's nothing to be attached to. Mind without obscuration, where without fear. So it's powerful to work with, because we can kind of, you know, you sort of work with this and sort of see. You know, we don't like figure it out, but kind of bring it into your practice once in a while maybe and see where we're sticky right now. you know, where is our letting go point? And of course it could be in the, you know, right in the middle of the heat of life, the difficult thing we're trying to work out with, a difficult person we're trying to work out with, and, you know, that which seems impossible about them and impossible about us and all that stuff. Right there is where we can find freedom. Rodney said, our whole life has been about awareness seeing forms, but the reality is that awareness is formless. Living as unconditioned formless awareness while existing in the world of form. So that's kind of the deal, you know, living as unconditioned formless awareness while existing in the world of form. And, you know, think about the Buddha. What did he work 40 years? He walked 300 miles back and forth up and down the Ganges Valley talking to people who appeared in the world of form completely. And at the same time, he wasn't sticking anywhere. It's pretty amazing. So at the end of the Heart Sutra, there's this famous mantra, Gate Gate Paragate Parasam Gate Bodhisvaha. And it's often translated as gone, gone, gone beyond, gone altogether beyond. What an awakening, aha! Mm-hmm. So it's kind of beyond, beyond, beyond. Yeah, it's really great. And in some versions of the sutta, the Buddha emerges from meditation. He commends Avalokiteshvara for his presentation. He says, well said, son of lineage, it is like that. It is like that. One should practice the profound perfection of wisdom just as you have indicated, even the Tathagatas rejoice, the awakened beings. There's a nice little book. I think I have it. Oh, it's in that. Can you, there's a little book in there. Could you grab that, please? In the gray pack by, this says, you know, local Provence. There's a guy, some of you may know Red Pine. Do you know who Red Pine is? He lives in Port Townsend. And Red Pine, yeah, he's done a lot of stuff in Chinese world. He's did a great book about hermits in China. But this is, I mean, there's a bunch of books. This is a very nice book that I was really appreciating about the Heart Sutra with his own translation. But there's all kinds, you know, there's tons of stuff. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, go into Wikipedia about Heart Sutra and it goes, it's huge. Well, it's the heart. It's the heart of awakening, kind of the heart of the matter. So that's kind of what I had to offer.